Hi everyone, I'm Chris Saldana and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. And this month, I'm interviewing Dr. Thomas D. and Dr. Sally Nuwama about the causes and potential consequences of declining enrollment in K-12 public schools. Professor D. is the Barnett Family Professor at Stanford University's Graduate School of Education, and Professor Nuwama is an Assistant Professor of Urban Politics and Human Development, Social Policy, and Political Science at Northwestern University. In the first part of this month's episode, Dr. D. details the factors contributing to declining enrollment in U.S. K-12 public schools. As always, we hope this month's podcast is helpful, interesting, and useful. So there have been several reports published about declining enrollment in K-12 public schools. So for listeners who may not be familiar with the issue of declining enrollment, why should educational stakeholders care about it?
Well, I think there are two broad reasons that the enrollment declines we're seeing are so important. One is that it's an important leading indicator of how the pandemic has disrupted learning opportunities for students. And what it tells us is kind of variegated. It can indicate students are truant or dropping out. It has indicated that students have experienced disruptions from having to switch schools. And there is an existing literature about how these kinds of reactive school switches can harm student learning. And also, they provide us some evidence that, in particular, younger students have been delaying or skipping instructional opportunities. So it's a somewhat crude, but an important indicator in the context of the pandemic, when many of the usual types of assessments we use became somewhat vexed. So, for example, some of the early data from kind of formative and high stakes tests became either not available or available under very different circumstances where students were taking it in different formats, different test structures, and a shifting population of students taking them. So, I think enrollment data have played and will continue to play a really critical role as this kind of canary in a coal mine, a leading indicator of the kinds of disruption students are experiencing. And critically, I want to stress another important feature of them, apart from their universality and their timeliness, is the fact that they're shining a light on some students we might otherwise miss. Students who fall through the cracks of more conventional data systems. So I'll be happy to say more about that later, but let me also stress a second key feature of enrollment data and why they're so important right now in thinking about academic recovery and the road ahead. It's that, the substantial enrollment declines we've seen in many school districts imply a long-term fiscal threat for public education. Not everywhere, but in many places, there have been substantial and sustained declines in enrollment that are going to put financial pressure on schools to confront the possibility of closing under-enrolled schools. And we know from a prior literature that that can be an incredibly vexed undertaking, one that puts vulnerable students at risk as they're potentially reassigned and often done so in the least advantageous ways. But also, closing schools really just rends at the fabric of communities and just becomes a very difficult and painful episode. And so I think we are anticipating with sustained enrollment declines and also the imminent sunsetting of federal support running into the so-called fiscal cliff, that this is going to be a challenge many communities are facing.
Do we have a sense for the size of the problem and why enrollments might be declining? So were they declining before the pandemic, or was this a pandemic specific event, or will they continue to decline after?
Yeah, I think prior to the pandemic, we were anticipating longer run enrollment declines in the face of declining birth rates and reduced immigration. But those changes were really relatively modest. In the pre-pandemic years, you would often see public school K-12 enrollment change within a bandwidth that seldom exceeded 0.5 percentage point. But between the fall of 2019 and the fall of 2021, the first two full school years under the pandemic, nationwide K-12 enrollment fell by over 4 times that amount. Roughly like 2.5%, a loss of roughly 1.2 million students out of the roughly 50 million students enrolled in public schools. So that was just a really sharp, vertiginous change that occurred over a really short time period. So I think it has accelerated some of the longer term kind of demographic changes that were going to be reshaping public education over the longer term. Now, in terms of the root causes, I think, obviously the pandemic drove this, but I think did so in interesting ways. I mean, a part of it is we see a substantial role for demographic change. And again, the school age population in the US was declining already, but the pandemic created a great deal of domestic mobility within the US. So we saw some states in particular, California, New York, Illinois, had pretty substantial declines in their school age population as there was out migration. And those states were the ones that had the largest public school enrollment declines, on the order of not 2 or 2.5%, which was the nationwide decline, but 4 or 5% in places like California and New York. For example, in California, over that 2-year period, the decline was over 250,000 students out of that 1.2 million students. So really substantial changes. Whereas in other states like Florida and Texas, they experienced some enrollment declines, but those declines were muted by the fact that there was domestic immigration. And so I think a lot of this reflects structural changes that were occasioned by the pandemic. People responding to the eventual run-up in housing costs, but also what we're seeing in terms of an enduring shift in the labor force to work from home arrangements. And we're seeing now that, before the pandemic, it was generally maybe 3 to 5% of person hours in the labor force were done remotely. And that spiked initially in the pandemic, but has now settled to a number that's in the range of 25 to 30%. So still many times a multiple of what it was during the pandemic. Many more people are working from home, not necessarily all the time. It could be in a hybrid setting, but that has contributed to demographic mobility too. And the final thing I'll say, and this is apropos of the political moment, I think, is the policy decisions we made contributed to enrollment decline. I worked with a wonderful doctoral student here at Stanford, Liz Huffaker, and some data journalists here at Stanford to do a quasi-experimental study about how school reopening decisions influenced enrollment declines. And we do see that the decision to go fully remote in fall of 2020 did contribute substantially to the flight from public schools. And we have a forthcoming study documenting that in the American Educational Research Journal. And we see that this is something that's very much in the political discourse now as people are trying to kind of have this somewhat, I think, politically biased kind of rehash of the decisions we made about school reopening. And I want to stress that though we find that closing schools led to enrollment decline. That's only one part of the very difficult decisions we face there. I mean, parents really did, many of them did try to seek other alternatives, but there were also very real public health concerns about keeping schools open. So I don't think the answers to that question are very easy or straightforward.
You mentioned that tracking trends in enrollment will be important for shining a light on specific student subgroups that might in other data sets or another analysis might fall through the cracks. What do we know about the kinds of students that have been leaving schools or that remain in schools?
Yeah, so we're seeing some really striking heterogeneity in the character of the exodus from public schools. And I think far and away the most striking feature is how much of it was concentrated among the very youngest learners. In particular, in the fall of 2020, there was a really striking decline in kindergarten enrollment, as well as really substantial declines in enrollment in grades 1, 2, and 3, early elementary grades. And I also want to stress, too, over this period, we saw a substantial decline in pre-K enrollment. Nearly a decade of progress, for example, in increasing enrollment in state-run pre-K programs was wiped out during the pandemic. So I think that heterogeneity is important because it's telling us which students really seem to have experienced the most substantial disruptions in learning opportunities. And it's among these youngest kids. And so I've been talking to people about this as a potential bias in how we're understanding the educational impact of the pandemic and a bias in how we're structuring our academic recovery. Many educators are rightfully focused on the challenges of the students who are sitting in front of them and trying to make available to them thoughtful interventions like high-quality tutoring, for example. But the enrollment data are telling us that there's a kind of bias from what I call a streetlight effect. We're focusing on where the data are shining a bright light, but missing the types of students who aren't in those conventional data systems. So in particular, I'm thinking of these younger learners who aren't necessarily sitting in classrooms because they've been skipping or delaying kindergarten, or may have switched to alternative schooling. For example, we've recently documented a surprisingly large and sustained run-up in homeschooling enrollment. And also kids who may be falling through the cracks because they're truant. And we don't have a great idea about where some of the kids who left public school have gone. We are seeing some modest growth in private schooling, surprisingly sustained growth in homeschooling. But in many states, those observed changes and the demographic change don't explain all of the public school enrollment loss. And so I think there are at least three compelling explanations for what's going on here. One is some kids are being homeschooled and they simply haven't registered with the state. Some could be due to truancy we haven't diagnosed. And also it may be that many families are simply choosing to skip kindergarten in states where that's allowed. And I do see some indirect evidence for that third hypothesis, because when we looked across states at where there appeared to be missing kids, a decline in public school enrollment that could not be explained by these other factors, it was really concentrated in states like California that do not require kindergarten attendance. So, but all of this is really consequential for learning. If some of our, you know, youngest learners who are at this incredibly propitious, malleable stage of intellectual development are missing instruction, that matters for our recovery. And it's, again, a type of streetlight effect, a type of bias, because it's not something we're paying as much attention to. There was a survey of school business officials last fall that received some attention, where they discussed where their spending priorities were with federal funds. And early childhood and community engagement, family engagement, were the lowest priorities in their spending. So I think we're missing some key challenges in the academic recovery that the enrollment data tell us matter, that where learning disruptions have been substantial, and where there might be challenges that we're not necessarily seeing from the kids who are still showing up to public schools.
So you've already started to answer my last question, but are there any specific recommendations that you want policymakers to have top of mind about declining enrollment and the consequences that it might have for schools?
Yeah, I think we face such a challenge now as we anticipate the imminent sunsetting of the federal ESSER support. I mean, fundamentally, I think we need sustained and broad state and federal leadership in support of an ongoing academic recovery. And I say that because I think many local districts, I mean, look, there are real advantages to local control of education in terms of engaging communities, in terms of tailoring support to the needs of a particular community. But I think this crisis has underscored some of the shortcomings of local control. In particular, I think many educators are struggling with just meeting the learning challenges the pandemic created for the kids who are showing up to the schoolhouse every day. And I'm not downplaying those challenges. I think they are considerable. And in particular, I would underscore, among many enrolled kids, one of the things we're seeing as an issue is chronic absenteeism. The changes observed in California are an extraordinary red flag. We've seen chronic absenteeism rates in California double from roughly 14% to 30% as schools came back to in-person instruction. So even among students that are currently enrolled in public schools, I think there's real concern that some students are failing to re-engage in the learning enterprise. And that's going to vex any other academic recovery effort. You can't provide tutoring and intervention and tiers of support to students who aren't, who may be enrolled but aren't showing up regularly. So schools are dealing with crises like that, and I think need state and federal support and leadership and guidance in doing that well. But they also critically need it to help create supports for kids who are falling through the cracks, the kids we don't see in the current data systems, the truant kids, the dropouts, and also critically, the younger learners who aren't even going to age into the testing windows that capture our attention until federal support has run out. Those kids who skipped kindergarten at the beginning of the pandemic are just going to begin to hit those grade three testing windows within a couple of years. And I think it would be smart to have, again, leadership, not just at the local level, but at the state and federal level, to begin doing early assessments to think about ways we can support those kids before they enter the testing windows that are more likely to capture our attention.
In the second part of this month's episode, Professor Nwama details the consequences and implications of a common response to declining enrollment, school closures. She details in particular the relationship between school closures and democratic participation and engagement for Black families.
So I know it's impossible to summarize everything that you found in your book, but what were some of your findings about the relationship between school closures and democratic participation and engagement that you found most alarming?
Yes. So I think one of the really interesting aspects of this entire project is I often get a question of, well, these schools were built, you know, post-World War II. They were built for 3,000 students. They have 300 students in them, right? Like maybe they should be closed. Or they say maybe people have sort of a conspiracy theory. They think that these people are trying to do, undermine their communities, but perhaps, you know, they aren't doing as well academically and they could use something different. And I think you can come into these communities and sort of raise these questions. And I think the most important thing to take away is that the communities were and are right about their suspicions around the school district and if those policies are actually valuable contributors to the future of the young people that live in those communities. And so one thing that's important to note that I find in the book is that in a place like Chicago, about 90% of those affected by school closures were Black and Brown students who were also largely low income. In this case, we measured this by your eligibility for free school lunch. And while those who were affected by closures were largely Black and Brown, when we did surveys of support for school closure, many of those who supported school closures were actually white people. And so these are people who are not directly impacted by this policy, you know, for whom school closures should not, in theory, impact them, you know, and yet there was these strong preferences for supporting closures. And so that's an interesting thing that we kind of find and explore, especially because Americans are typically perceived as largely supportive of public schools, right? And so why are they supportive of school closure? Right. And I think that becomes an interesting piece of it. The other thing that I think is important is that, you know, we live in a democracy where people say, if you don't vote, don't say anything. Right. The idea is that your participation is what justifies democratic responsiveness. Well, in the book, I find that these groups that have low resources, which are typically associated with low participation, end up participating after they hear about their school's threat for closure more than any other group an American democracy. And so what does that mean? That means not only did they attend the community meetings, that were set up by the district to defend against the closures. They led protests. They also got every single ward to create petitions to create an elected school board. They also voted more than any other group in the city area. So they sort of did all of the things that you would sort of expect a group to engage in if they want policy change. But by 2015, there's still no elected school board. Rahm Emanuel, who was the one who led to the closure in Chicago, is reelected a mayor, you know? And so they get the sense that they're engaging in everything democracy would demand, but democracy is still closed to them, right? They're not getting the kind of responsiveness that one would expect for the kind of engagement, the high levels of political engagement that they're engaged in. And so that's also a really key aspect of, I think, what turned this into a book for me, because it really follows these groups as they do everything that's required of them, but don't necessarily experience the substantial or requisite response that you would expect from a group that already doesn't have as much, right? They have less time, less money, less resources overall, but they're participating the most, but they're getting the least.
That's a perfect segue into my next question, which you go beyond just studying the relationship between school closures and democracy in that you also look at the impact of this process on communities who, quote unquote, win, right? Who stop the school closure and who in theory are now better off because their school is safe. And you introduce this concept of collective participatory debt. I'm wondering if maybe you can talk a little bit about that and what you found in those communities that were able to stop school closures.
I'm so glad you asked that question, because that was actually part of one of the most revelatory parts of this project, which is probably what you meant by the previous question when you said surprising finding. yeah, is that people ultimately felt like even when they win, they lose. They often felt like they were engaged in what I would describe as sort of a Pyrrhic victory, like they saved their school, but at a really unsustainable and great cost. And this is because even when communities, quote unquote, saved their school from closure, they were essentially met with other policies that were meant to undermine those efforts almost immediately after, which helped them to see that they were, in fact, not just fighting to save a school, right? That they were actually fighting for larger and some more substantial structural changes in the ways that they experience sort of racism and sexism and gentrification in their communities, right? And that this was just one small manifestation of that in the form of school closures. And so people recognized that. And even as they moved to try to change those things, for example, getting the mayor at the time out of office, they found that their efforts weren't met with sort of the outcomes you would expect. And so I call this collective participatory debt. And what it really means specifically is it's indicative of a type of mobilization fatigue that transpires when citizens who are engaged in the policy process are met with a lack of democratic transparency and responsiveness, despite high levels of repeated participation in it. And so in the case of school closures, what you see is two things. One, when they go to these community meetings and they do the things that the sort of government says they should to defend against the closure, they realize that those processes themselves aren't actually democratic, right? That they're sort of these charades that the government puts on to make them feel like they're participating in democracy. And then it also accrues because people realize over time that the outcomes are also not sort of democratic. And so they participate and then they ask, okay, what are you going to do with the information we just shared with you? And there's no clear, transparent way of understanding how they're going to take that feedback and make a decision. And so people see that they're being gaslit, essentially. But the people aren't everyone, right? They recognize that the people who are being gaslit look a particular way and have resources and they're low income and they're Black. And so they're taught a lesson about democracy, but also how democracy values citizens who look like them. And they see their value as citizens relative to others. And so this actually, I talk about this normatively, undermines their desire to participate in the future, because they recognize that even if they do what the social contract of democracy claims they should, that they may not be met with the requisite kind of response. And this is deeply unfortunate because groups that are that have low incomes and are already marginalized groups sort of typically only have this available to them to enact any kind of change. And so if they become uninterested or too fatigued to participate, right? And then that removes the only lever available to them at all. And so that raises larger questions about sort of whose responsibility it is and what these groups are owed. And I really try to end the book and think about CPD as really asking questions about what democracy owes these groups, right? And where the burden should be. I think it's wonderful that people celebrate, you know, the civil rights, leaders of the civil rights movements, or even contemporary members of the Black Lives Matter movement for the kind of sacrifice that they engage in on behalf of people of color more broadly. But I think we have to raise questions about how much sacrifice should be necessary for groups to be treated as humans, for people to have the kind of full access to what democracy promises, especially a group that's already marginalized, right? And so CPD is really just recognizing that sacrifice has cost and that those costs have consequences that may undermine the ability for these groups to participate fully in democracy and to gain what democracy claims that all of its citizens should have.
Your book is so timely because, as you know, schools are still reeling from the pandemic and also facing declines in enrollment, with the biggest declines being in the largest districts. So I'm curious how you would advise district leaders, given your findings, as they think about what changes need to happen going forward, with those changes attending to the history that you've described and the experiences of Black families who have already been through a lot of school closures, and thinking about what can district leaders do?
So I want to first recognize, you know, the declines in population across major cities and the impact that that's had on schools, and that this is sort of a real policy issue that governments and school districts are working through. But I also want to recognize the roots of that decline and the fact that Chicago has lost 250,000 of its population, in part because of the closing of housing, public housing, and the closing of public hospitals that were directly racialized. When you have those kinds of closures that spawns gentrification and makes it unaffordable to live in the city, then you're going to have a school population that is experiencing the consequences of that, which is low enrollment. To have policies that are focused on closure, closing schools, is a reactionary policy that doesn't actually do anything about the fact that if we continue down this same path of closing hospitals, of public hospitals, of closing public housing, of expanding gentrification, of expanding luxury living as opposed to affordable options, then you're going to continue to have the issue even if you keep closing more schools. You don't actually resolve it. It's a very reactionary policy. I think policymakers have to think about addressing those root causes. But even in the schools themselves that they currently have, I'm really working to make them sort of community-centered institutions. And so communities are already doing this. I'm actually not saying anything that is new. And so both in Philadelphia, in Newark, but also in Chicago, you see people proposing and creating community centered schools that, for example, propose that schools have clinics within them, which becomes especially important when you consider the hospital deserts that are occurring in places like Chicago and Philadelphia as well. And the fact that schools currently don't have full-time nurses, and that creates concerns around death, right, for young people. And so how do we actually make schools embody these sort of community hubs that are necessary when you also have the closure of libraries, right, like the closures of YMCAs and Boys and Girls Clubs? So many community members are really advocating for the kinds of schools that embody many of these things that have gone missing over the past 10 or 20 years, but that we know are critical for the strengthening of communities. I also want to make clear that the very processes that communities engage in to learn about the problems of their neighborhoods are also typically non-democratic and would benefit from being more democratic. And so what does that mean? So when schools were being threatened for close, communities found out in the paper and through like word of mouth, and it was a very blunt way. And then they had to attend these meetings in a few weeks. And when they attended these meetings, they spoke for 2 minutes. Each person had 2 minutes to speak, five per a school. And then there was no response from the district. They just said things sort of in the ether, and then there was no response. And then it was unclear what happened with the feedback. And when I had interviews with the school district leaders, they would say things like, well, we honestly never really expected people to turn out or for it to be taken this seriously, or for us to have to actually like account for what the feedback said. And so there was really no intention for it to be a truly democratic process where people were given the problem and then asked, what do we actually do, right? In that case, maybe people would have said, oh, let's consolidate. You know, maybe that would have been an outcome. But instead, they were presented with a problem and the solution, asked to comment on it without any clear process for making sure that that was taken into account. So the process itself just wasn't democratic. And I think that if people trust communities to think about through the challenges that they have and to create solutions for them, for themselves, I think that people would be surprised at the things that they would come up with. And it would actually be pretty helpful. I think that people are very realistic because they have to be, right? In so many areas of their lives. And so on one end, I think it's important to think about addressing the root challenges that create the conditions for low enrollment to be possible if you want to actually address it head on and not have the same problems in the future. Second, I think it's important to think about the proposals that are already been raised by communities, for example, creating community schools that have the kind of services that young people need, for example, health, health services, library services, as well as, lunch and community oriented things that are already done through like Boys and Girls Clubs and YMCAs. And then finally, I think it's important that when there are challenges that communities are facing, because of course they evolve and they change, that those things are brought to a community to engage with collectively around problem solving, as opposed to providing them a solution and then asking them to comment on them, letting them actively be a part of the solving process. I think those things make a huge difference for the kinds of solutions that communities come up with. And so those are some things that I think are simple enough, but are not done enough, but that could make a pretty significant difference.
Thank you, Professor D and Professor Nuama, for being on this month's podcast. As always, we hope you're safe and healthy. And remember that for the latest analysis on education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu and follow NEPC on Twitter at NEPC Tweets.